somebody needs to mute.
But for some reason, it's not seeing.
What? Oh, you mean the numerical code? Can I get it to you? I need to convene the meeting, so give me. No, I'm good. Okay, let's convene the meeting. This is the August 9th Clallam PUD Commission meeting, virtual. We'll be doing virtual for a while, I think.
Hey, Will.
Yeah.
Doug's having some connectivity issues. He asked just to give him just a second.
Okay, sure. Let me know when he's on, Will.
Okay, will do.
He's consistent.
Well, I had all the troubles before we started, so maybe it's contagious. Doug's having trouble getting on. Doug's having trouble getting on, so we'll give him some time to. We just got IT support headed down, so we'll see how it goes. Technology is great when it works.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Can you hear us now?
Yeah, we got you.
Okay, I'm going to take off the headphones because they're not working. Can you see us and hear me both now?
Can see you and hear you, so I guess we're good.
Okay.
All right, in case you missed that, Doug, we're convening the August 9th Clallam PUD Commission meeting. Virtually welcome everyone. So we've called to order. Let's move on to approval of the consent agenda.
I move that we accept the consent agenda.
I'll second that motion.
Been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda for August the 9th, 2021. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, good. Thank you. Next item is agenda revisions. Doug, you've got one of revision. You want to cover that?
Yeah, just on the business items, we had overlooked adding what we have on all meetings now, the BPA post-2028 contract discussions. That should be, say, under business items number E. So that was inadvertently left off.
Okay, we'll add that one.
Yeah, I saw that. Thanks, Doug.
Our next item is comments from the public. Sean, do we have comments?
Nothing in the chat, Will, but if anybody wants to make a comment, please give me your first name now and I'll start a list. Hearing none, Will.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. All right, under business items, our first item is the cost of service presentation by FCS Group. Sturgey, I believe you're on, right? So.
Yeah, I was just going to introduce Sergey real quick, Will. He's from FCS Group, and we have used FCS Group now for our last three cost of service studies, one each for water and one for electric. And then we're now doing an updated cost of service in 2021. And so Sergey has a presentation that he's going to go through with the commissioners, and then we'll entertain any questions along the way. So, Sergey, with that, I'm going to go ahead and allow you to share your screen so you can pull up the presentation there. And you're muted, Sergey.
Thank you, Sean. Sorry about that. Let me see. I am going to be sharing my screen now. Can everybody see my presentation full screen?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, we see it. Thank you.
All right. Well, good afternoon, commissioners. Thank you for being here to with you. Let me restart. Thank you for meeting with me today to talk to you about the results of the cost of service and rate study update. As Sean had mentioned, this is kind of our second go-through of the electric system after our original study with the electric and the water utilities. So before we dive in, I wanted to go through a quick overview of our presentation. We're going to start out by talking about the overall rate setting process, kind of big picture, in case you remember from the prior studies or if this is your first go through, just to give you a high-level overview what actually goes into these type of studies. And then we'll dive into each of the key components and steps of the rate study, called the revenue requirement, cost of service, and rate design. We'll go over what these are, what goes into them, what assumptions we incorporated in developing these components, and kind of bring everything back in terms of the results of the study. As we go through, feel free to ask questions anytime you have any. There will be some terms that we go through, some acronyms that we use throughout the slides. Feel free to either reference this slide 3 or just let me know during the presentation. Alternatively, if you're going to be looking back afterwards, slide 3 should have majority, if not all, the acronyms defined. And finally, before kind of diving into the meat of the discussion, just to give you a background of the legal authority, Revised Code of Washington 54-24-080 grants PUDs the rights to charge rates and charges for services. Here, we try to highlight things that are most pertinent to our discussion, kind of that the rates and charges shall be fair. Now, fairness can be subjective, so we like to interpret that as equitable, because in the industry of rate setting, equity has a methodology. There's a rate-supported methodologies throughout. The RCW also indicates that the revenue should be sufficiently set to cover your principal and interest or your debt service, and cover your operating and maintenance expenses, as well as necessary repairs of the system, so capital. So basically, you need to set your rates equitably to recover your costs. So now let's kind of focus in on the study itself. So just as a quick refresher or a high-level overview, a typical rate study such as this one usually consists of 3 key analytical steps. The first one is typically referred to as the revenue requirement, and all we're doing here is trying to identify the overall needs to support the utility. Can our current rates meet our ongoing obligations? Step 2 breaks those needs down a little bit more. So if you think of step 1 as defining the size of the pie that we need to cover through our revenues, step 2 looks at how do we split that pie into pieces? Are there cost differences to provide a service to different type of classes? So here we're really looking at interclass equity. And finally, step 3 takes the results of the first 2 steps and develops the actual fixed and variable charges assessed to your customers. This is kind of the communication last step tool that you're going to be performing. This is kind of how you send them your message of the policies that you want to accomplish through your rates to your customers. So we'll be going through each one of these steps a little bit more detail moving forward, starting kind of with that first step, revenue requirement. So as I mentioned before, overall, what is it? It's a revenue requirement. Is just a comparison of your rates today to your ongoing obligations. The key message that I want to say here is that rates should be supporting their expenses on a standalone basis, meaning we're not relying on revenues from other utilities such as your water utility or other external sources to meet our ongoing costs. Now, when developing your revenue requirement, it's very important to focus beyond your direct expenses such as your operating and power, debt service capital. Really also make sure you're incorporating the appropriate policies into the equation just to make sure the utility is sustainable, not just today, but into the future. And speaking kind of that of that multi-year approach, we always emphasize that it is important to look out beyond your test year period, your budget year, to make sure you're not going to be falling off a cliff. If you know you have a big capital plan coming up in a couple of years or a big cost of power adjustment coming up potentially, you want to at least evaluate what that's going to do to your rates, and that way you'll be able to address it in multitude of ways. You can do inflationary adjustments, build up to it, instead of getting to that year, done nothing, and potentially facing a double-digit type of an adjustment. So kind of diving a little bit more into the components and details of the revenue requirement, the first key factor we're going to talk about in building the revenue requirement is the actual revenue or the revenue levels. Now, you can see visually the makeup of your revenues in the chart below. Here, our focus period will be an 8-year period, 2021 through 28. Now, the reason why we're going through 28 is just that right about that time where we have our contracts ending from Bonneville. Now, the emphasis here is not necessarily the pure long-term approach. We do, again, want to look out into the future just to make sure we're not falling off a cliff, anything major. But for our rate-setting discussion purposes, we're going to be focusing on the next couple of years. So, again, the future outlook is just there to show you what we're seeing, what we're forecasting, if there's anything major on the horizon. But the focus in the discussion will probably be just around the next couple of years for emphasis purposes. So looking at that graphic down below, you can see that the majority of your revenues are coming from your rate revenues. The alternative, the only other source of revenues that you have is your non-rate revenues, which includes rental income, interest earnings, broadband, conservation, and miscellaneous revenues, really only about 4% of your total revenue. So again, there's not a lot of other sources that you have to meet your costs. Now, because you're currently assessing taxes on top of your bills, we're going to be deducting taxes from our discussion, so they're not going to be included in both revenues as well as expenses, which is the next slide coming up. So without taxes, you're collecting about $65.5 million to $69.3 million. And the way we're getting to that number is we're using historical actual statistics. We're applying current rates in place today using the load forecast we've worked through in detail with your staff, basically tying to the Bonneville Power Administration load forecast that was submitted and projecting costs that way into the future. On the expenses side, we are starting the forecast with your 2021 budget. Again, during the timing of the completion of the study, the 2021 budget was the latest information available. We did work in quite a bit of detail with your staff to make sure we're not carrying any one-time costs into the future. So we went over the line items to make sure we deduct anything that was one-time included in the costs. We're making any adjustment, known changes into the future outside of 21 budget, which include any costs related to implementation of AMI due to meter reading cost adjustments, any retirements that may be occurring, as well as any potential future additional FTE needs. So we're not only using the budget and inflating with general cost inflation ranging from 2.3% to 3.5%, we're also making those additional adjustments that are known as best as we can with your staff's help. So the average inflation rate that we're seeing right now is about 3.1% for our forecast on the O&M side of the costs. And again, taxes are not included because we're not including them in the revenues as well. So our total – oh, go ahead.
Let me jump in and ask a question here, if I might. That inflation rate, how current is that? Because, you know, we previously have talked about material cost is escalating quite heavily, things like copper.
So. Right. So this is not as reflective of the current market conditions as it is more kind of general what we've been seeing the last couple of years. We do realize, you know, we got some latest information from a couple of different studies just today. We're talking about it. Some labor costs were going up 30% in one utility capital planning cost side on their projects. So we are seeing that. We're hedging against that being a recurring event. So there is a little bit of a less of a conservative approach here for forecasting costs. So it's not as current as just today. It's more a little bit more historic.
You know, I guess if you've done a sensitivity analysis of a range of inflation rates.
We have run scenarios and done more. The item that we'll be discussing in a couple slides is the importance of policies and carrying appropriate reserves. this is where that flexibility, if you have appropriate reserves on hand, you should be able to have a range of reasonable forecasts. And if the reserves are set appropriately, it gives you enough time to make modifications. So if we did set a little low and if we have enough reserves, you can come back and modify as necessary.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So you can see that our O&M expenses range from about $23 million to $28.5 million, and you can kind of see down below the breakdown of the expenses in the bars summarized below, starting kind of the top with the transmission portion, kind of local transmission expenses, customer service, distribution costs, and administrative and general type of expenses. The next key factor is a pretty substantial one. It's related to power costs. We are modeling your power cost expenses by month, so we're doing a pretty detailed forecast tying to the load forecast and the billing determinants in the Bonneville Power Administration rate schedule. So we are using their 2022 draft rates. And because we are modeling out in the future, we did have to make some assumptions for future adjustments. Bonneville usually sets rates in a two-year biannual period. They don't really look beyond that period, and they do it on pretty much consistently every 2 years. So since we are looking at pretty much four Bonneville rate-setting periods, we have to make some assumptions going into the future. So for Bonneville costs, we are assuming close to inflation, 5.5% power cost adjustments, and a little bit higher in transmission since they've been talking about investing heavier on the transmission side moving forward. Now, we do realize we didn't account for the draft rates, which are actually a slight decrease in rates in the front end. So this is strictly what I'm showing you is more outside of the current rate setting period. So the current rate setting period includes a minor reduction in power costs and about a 10% increase in transmission, kind of tying to what they've been published. Going beyond that, we're assuming 5.5% and 8% for transmission. Now, we are forecasting the need for above rate high watermark purchases, so we're showing the need to purchase about 1.6 to 4.1 average megawatts for a total of about $29.3 to $36.3 million.
Sergey, this is Commissioner Waddell. I have a question. On your assumption about the 5.5% biannually power increase from BPA, tell me a little bit more about your assumptions there.
For now, just strictly and across the board on the power side, costs will go up 5.5% higher than they are currently. It will be in fiscal year 2022. So in fiscal year 2024, they will go up 5.5% for modeling purposes.
Yeah, I mean, is that just based on what you believe is
More inflation, you know, going back to 2011, they had a 9.5% adjustment for just power increase. Then the next fiscal year, 14, they had a 7.5%. Then they followed it up with a 5.5%. Then they had more like 1.5%, and now it's a small reduction. So it's kind of an average of the last four or five rate cycles, basically trying to hedge with inflation. We've seen them do more. We've seen them do less. So it's really hard to know what they're going to be doing in the next, you know, two to three years out.
Okay, well, thanks.
So that's.
Adam, did you think that it should be higher or lower? Or
at this point, they've been trending kind of lower with a reduction this period and a little bit in the 1.5% average last time. So I think inflation is reasonable at this time.
So
my only thought is that as we approach 2028, I think Bonneville is going to do everything they can to keep their rates lower.
Mm-hmm.
So this might be on the high end, I think.
Ryan, this is where, go ahead.
Well, I'm agreeing with Rick. Yeah, I believe they're just basically making it look good to.
The contracts are signed.
Contracts.
Right. Yeah, that's possible.
That's the Senate.
So this is where that little bit of flexibility comes in. On the prior slide, you saw that we might be a little low on our inflation assumptions for O&M expenses just because what we've been seeing due to the pandemic and the follow-up events. We might be potentially a little higher just due to the nature of what Bonneville might be doing, trying to convince folks to stay with them. So, again, these things are most likely balancing themselves out all around about an inflationary assumption weighted together.
This is John. We had a lengthy discussion with FCS on these escalations for fiscal year 24 and beyond. And we were in general agreement that this was probably a little bit conservative, but at the same time, the impact is more than 2 years away and does not cover the current rate planning period of the next couple of years.
It may be a good idea, since rates are adjusted every 2 years biannually. This 5.5% is a biannual increase, or is that annual?
The 5.5 is biannual. So
okay, so it's 2.25.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good.
Any other questions on the power side?
Well, the only given that that's a annual or biannual and have to divide that by two, the transmission might be a little on the low side, but I think it's good enough.
Okay. Thank you. So I'll go to the next one, but if you have any other things you want to mention, we can always come back to the prior slide as well. So the last kind of that direct cost component or key factor that we wanted to cover is related to capital, and that's related to capital costs themselves and as well as debt service related to that capital. So in the current 8-year plan, we're looking at budgeted about or planned for, not budgeted, $93.6 million of projects inflated to the year of construction. Now, in order to fund these, we are projecting the use of the remainder of the 2018 revenue bonds. We have a little under $1 million left for projects in 2021 using those proceeds. We're also utilizing customer contributions, native construction, which is about $1 million or so per year, and the rest is being funded through either reserves, rate-funded capital, or any kind of cash purposes. We're not anticipating the need for any new debt at this time. So that's positive news. At this moment, we're not anticipating the need. Again, this is a long-term outlook. Things may change, but with the current assumptions, it does not appear there's a need for new borrowing. And finally, our current debt that we already have on hand is about $3.8 million to $3.6 million. The last cost component before we look at the results is that indirect cost component tied to financial policies and reserves. So on this slide, you'll see the summary of the four key policies that we have included in our analysis. And we'll start kind of the overview with the operating reserves. The first target is meant to be more of a liquidity cushion because the nature of how you're collecting revenues today and how you're incurring expenses is a little bit of volatile. You're having a lot more revenues in the cold times during the winter time, and then fairly low revenues collection in those shoulder months in the springtime and the fall time. So there's going to be differences in cyclical nature, how you're bringing money in and paying money out. So we want to have enough cash on hand. We also want to have a little bit of reserves on hand for any mild years in terms of weather. If we're anticipating an average year and we're having a mild winter, we might not be generating enough rates in that matter. So your current policies for operating reserves range from a minimum of 120 days up to a maximum of 180 days, which is a range of about $25 to $31.5 million on average in that 8-year time period. The second policy we're trying to cover or track is a rate stabilization reserve. It's just there to help you offset kind of revenue shortfalls, again, multiple years of, let's say, mild weather or something unexpected happened, a cost recovery adjustment clause comes in from Bonneville. We weren't planning for it. We have this reserve to help us smooth out rates. So this helps us avoid going to rates and having significant adjustments right away. It can help us smooth things out. Again, this is not an ongoing reliable source of funds. It's just there to help us smooth things over, help us get through a hump of unanticipated type of expenses. And the way you currently have structured your current reserve is that you can actually use it to meet coverage requirements if necessary, which is also a benefit. So the current target is about 6% of ongoing revenues, or about $3.8 to $4.6 million. The next policy target is more of a legal requirement. It's a debt service coverage requirement associated with revenue bonds. Basically, it's an insurance to creditors that you'll be making your payment. It's a ratio calculation that looks at your eligible revenues, net of eligible expenses. The net difference needs to be at least 1.25 times greater than your annual average revenue bond debt service. Now, the 1.25 is the bare minimum requirement. If you look at any kind of creditor that kind of preferences, what they say in terms of what will improve your rating, because if you want to save money in the future and a lower interest rate, you want to get a better rating, they're looking for a higher target. So the ideal target would be 2.0 or greater. So that's what the PD is currently targeting. And finally, we're also tracking the leverage ratio or debt to asset ratio, basically measuring what portion of your assets are being funded through equity versus debt. Higher ratio indicates that you own less of your assets, the creditors own more of your assets, and potentially could indicate that you're not able to repay your debts. Here, the target that we're looking at is 40% or lower. So we want to be lower than 40% for our rate setting purposes. So what does this all mean? So putting everything together, on this slide you'll find the summary of the revenue requirement. And there's a couple of things in the bar on the chart, so let me briefly go through it. Here, the stacked bars represent expenses made up of cash operating expenses of that darker bottom portion of the bar. The orange represents power. As you can see, it's a pretty substantial portion of your costs. And it's a portion of costs you don't have a lot of control over. Next is that yellow gold color, which represents existing debt. And finally, rate-funded capital in the brown. Now, if you compare those bars to the solid black line at the top, that shows your revenues under current levels. And what you're looking at here is that in 2021, we're pretty much at our expenses with the line. As we move out to 22 and thereafter, we're starting to fall deficient in terms of our ideal capital funding sources. So as we go over time with inflation, our costs are going up, our load growth is not increasing at the same rate of inflation, and we're becoming more deficient every year. Now, if you look at our reserves, which are represented with a shaded area in the background, the blue shaded area, this shows our level of our operating reserves. And the two lines down below, the black dashed line and the dotted blue line, represent the minimum and the maximum targets that we have for our operating policies, as we discussed in the prior slide. So what you're seeing is that in 2021, we're right between our minimum and maximum policy as we move down the line, assuming the incorporated rate strategy that you see down below of inflationary level increases is incorporated, we'll stay right in between those averages, and maybe down the road by 27, 28, we'll get close to the maximum target. But in the short term, those 2.25% increases will allow us to be somewhere in between our middle, in the middle of our minimum and maximum targets. So as I just mentioned, in order for us to keep up and be able to pay for our capital and keep our reserves within our internal limits, we need those inflationary adjustments about 2.25%. For an average customer using 1,350 kilowatt hours per month, that's about a little over $3 per month per year adjustment. So I'll pause here for a second. Do you have any questions? One last piece of information I wanted to say is that when we did the study last time, when we were projecting the rate plan, we're in the 3% range for our projections. So the positive news compared to our previous study, we're able to drop it down to 2.25. Again, mainly due to the power cost adjustments going down a little bit. So that is positive news. But it looks like we're still not, our cost of inflation is still outpacing our load growth and customer growth assumptions. So we still need to make adjustments for that inflation per year.
I believe in the past we've used 1,200 kWh or 1,250 or something like that. Was that a conscious increase for some reason?
We were looking at the latest average consumption for a typical residential home per year, so we adjusted it based on the most recent information we had.
Yeah, well, that's the new average as stated. I also want to emphasize the fact, which was pointed out too, about the 2.25 increase. As you know, previously we've had 3.5, 3.8. Forecasted out for a number of years. So this is very good news to be able to lower that percent increase.
So that 1350 is based on the pandemic year. Is that right? Does that mean that it could be lower? And I'm not questioning we should lower it. I'm just looking at the logic behind it.
Hey, Will, this is John. So basically, the old comparison of 1,200 or 1,250, I don't remember what we used to use, that was more of a state average. Of course, Clallam PUD is all electric. So the only change is we're looking at our electric bills as opposed to a more general assumption for the state. We thought that would be better information to convey to customers. And it is not really based on any additional usage due to COVID or anything else. That average is pretty typical per year for the last several years.
Okay. Well, yeah, we want to be specific to Clallam PUD, so that's good. Thank you.
I had a question about the irrigation rate. If I'm thinking about it right, it looks to me like the irrigation rate is less than the cost for irrigation for us.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that we're shifting the cost for irrigation to other customers?
So that's actually a discussion for the next section. If you wouldn't mind, we can kind of go through the cost of service discussion, and that's a great question for the results of that analysis. I'm more than happy to talk about it right now, or we can just get to that slide if you like.
That's fine.
Okay. Any other questions before we move on to that kind of cost of service equity related question? All right. So I'll move on. As always, please let me know if you want to revisit any topics we covered. So next we'll be going over the cost of service portion of the analysis. And again, we're going to be focusing, now that we have to hone in a little bit, we'll be focusing on that 2.25%. Now that we have identified the size of the pie that we need, which is a 2.25% adjustment, how do we split that pie up and figure out our current classes paying their equitable share of costs? Is irrigation paying their equitable share of costs? Our residential customers, general service, and so on. So again, as you can kind of see, at the very basic level, the equity is the point of this analysis. And in terms of developing the analysis, we do utilize industry standard practices and methodologies for developing the information, but we do use your specific detailed customer statistics, usage and demand information, planning and sizing criteria, as well as facility requirements. And in the end, we don't only answer the equity question, we also establish cost-based unit costs, which can then help us establish that last step, rate design, step three in the rate setting process. Now, overall, why is it even important to develop the cost of service analysis? Why do we even do it? Well, number one, as you saw in the beginning, that RCW legal reference, again, it dictates that rates should be set fairly, or as I mentioned, I like to say equitably. So a cost of service analysis really gives us a quantitative approach for establishing equity for assigning costs. Different customers benefit and use the system differently. A good example would be if, as an example, you had a customer, a large industrial customer, taking power from a transmission level, or even somebody taking power from a primary level, they're not using the system in the same way as a typical home is. They have their own transformers, they have their own secondary lines. They should not be paying for those costs for the remainder of the utility. So really what we want to do is align how your customers are using the system and charge them just for what they're using. That's kind of the goal and objective of a cost of service analysis. Now, in order to perform it, there is a three-step process as well. Step number one is we want to break your costs down into functions. What kind of a function do your costs perform? Are they related to procurement of electricity? Is it production, generation, purchasing of power? Is it transmission of power from the source to your distribution network? Is it distributing the energy to your customers' meters and to their doors? Or is it a general type of cost? Then within each function of service, we want to categorize and classify the costs into separate cost pools. So all we're doing is aligning costs that are the same in nature into costs that are related to demand or peaking, which we'll be covering a little bit more in the next slide, costs related to energy that are variable in nature, costs that are more fixed in nature, which we typically call as customer type costs, and finally, any costs that may be directly assigned to any specific customer or customer group. Finally, once we have classified our expenses, we move on to developing allocation factors using historical statistics and developing allocation factors and redistributing those costs to customer classes. So on this slide, you'll see a visual.
Let me jump in and ask you a quick question. Under CETA, the lower income folks that meet certain criteria will be subsidized by some of the other customers. Did you include that in this analysis?
We did include the cost of the subsidy, the surcharge subsidy, as part of this analysis, yes.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So on this slide, you'll find a summary of the classification process. So in the darker color in the upper right of the chart, you'll see that energy represents about 38% of your total cost. Now, energy costs are those that vary with the consumption of electricity. They typically are considered variable, and they, depending how big the customer is, how much electricity they use on a monthly basis, they'll get assigned more or less of those costs. And usually these costs are measured in kilowatt hours. It could be annually, it could be on a monthly basis. Next, we have demand costs in orange, kind of down at the bottom, 30% of your total expenses. Now, these costs could be a little bit tricky to understand. These are costs related to oversizing your system to meet a maximum rate of use. And that maximum rate of use can happen within a certain point in time, let's say a billing period. Now, that maximum peak can occur day one of the billing period, or it can occur on day 30, 31 of the billing period. Now, the best example I like to use is for, you know, your family getting together on a holiday. If everybody gets together, let's say on a Christmas, it's cold outside. Everybody's family and the neighbor's family are coming over. Everybody's using every single device, heater, and oven in the house. That happens for 1 or 2 days, then everybody goes home and the system is not operating nearly to that capacity. Well, the utility needs to size their infrastructure to meet that peak day use, peak year use, pretty much, being able to meet it at all times. And just because it's not being utilized all the time doesn't mean it wasn't designed and it's not there to maintain, operate, make sure it's always available for your customers. So the folks that are requiring us to develop and size the system should be proportionally paying for that peak upsizing requirement as well. Now, usually peak demand is represented through kind of point in time KW kilowatt measure, unit of measure.
So this used to be called a ratchet clause. So if your demand went way up, it just stays there because you have to call on those resources.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
I guess the other question is, as we build out our AMI system, we're talking about doing time of day metering. Did you consider that at all in your long range projections?
So, right, we are incorporating assumptions for the cost of the AMI metering infrastructure, and we are making estimates and using load research to incorporate what the results of the AMI information will be able to provide us in the analysis as well. So that is being accounted for. What AMI will do is just to help us enhance the output of the information and will give us alternative rate strategy approaches. So as you mentioned, time of use rates, demand billing for everybody will become available, EV rates, all those type of rate structures will become available once AMI has been deployed.
Okay, thank you.
Sergey, I want to make sure I understood your response there.
Uh-huh.
Are you saying that you have incorporated behavior modification for our customers with respect to the load forecast going forward?
We're making smaller assumptions for load factor assumptions, especially residential customers. We're making an assumption that net metering will become more prominent and load factors will change slightly over time. Not a significant change, but a slight change over time. So we did make minor tweaks like that for our long-range forecast.
Thank you.
Okay. And the final cost component that we have incorporated, or the outcome of this of the classification process, is the customer cost component. Here, these are basically fixed costs in nature. These are costs tied basically to adding one or deletion of one customer from the system. The easiest cost example would be postage in my mind. It costs you the same to send an envelope and a postage stamp to a residential customer versus an industrial or a commercial customer. It doesn't matter how much they use, it costs the same for a stamp. Now, what's important to remember is that these cost components should also include a portion of your backbone. So just to get one unit of electricity to the front door of anybody's house, you need a pole in the ground, you need a transformer, and you need some wires. Now, the size and the oversizing of those wires and poles, that's a different question, but at least that base infrastructure partially should be recovered through these customer fixed-type costs. So putting everything together, on this slide you'll see the results of the cost of service analysis. So we're displaying the results in two ways. The table down below shows you the numerical representation. I'll quickly go through that table just to make sure it makes sense. Here, the first column shows you how we're projecting 2022 rates will be collected today. The COSTA column shows you what the allocation methodology says the way it should be collected. And then the dollar difference and the percentage difference is the adjustment required to get to cost of service. So if the number is positive, that class needs to go up to get to cost of service. If the number is negative, then the class needs to go down to get to cost of service. Now, the benefit of having the numbers is to see the magnitude of the class compared to the total of the dollars. So as an example, the question was regarding irrigation. You can see how big of a class it is compared to everybody else. Now, if you look at the visual representation at the top, here you'll notice there's a solid black line showing the average increase. That's about 2.25% that we talked about. There's a bit of rounding showing it as a 2.3. And if the bar is above that line, it shows that the class is not quite paying their equitable share of costs and needs to go up more than average. And if the bar is below that line, it says it needs to go down or be a little bit below to get the cost of service. Now, because of changes year to year, because of how, the pandemic is a good example, because of how we budget different line items differently, different type of expenses, there's always going to be a little bit of fluctuation from year to year, changes in cost of service. You'll never be exactly precisely on 0% for everybody. So that's why we say in the realm of reason, there's a realm of reasonableness in cost of service rate setting that about 5% plus or minus within the average, you'll be within the realm of cost of service average. So that would be negative 3.25 to positive 7.25%. If you're anywhere within that range, you can be considered within cost of service. Now, looking at the results, we can see that residential is right within that range. The residential is within the cost of service range of reasonableness. General service, including industrial customer classes, are paying a little bit more than their allocable share, so they can decrease towards cost of service. Seasonal irrigation is the biggest class that's unaligned from cost of service. And in general, the findings are consistent with the prior study. So this is kind of where we get to your question from before. The way that the results are showing that irrigation class is not paying their equitable share of costs, and if we were to make them equitable, they would have a pretty substantial adjustment. Now, in terms of overall the size and magnitude of this class, it's a very small class overall, so it would not be a significant dollar impact. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, yes. I just question why we're so undercharging the irrigators. Is that purposeful? I guess that's a question for Will or Jim.
You know, if that's intermittent usage, so based on the amount of energy used, it would not be huge. And so then it becomes a deal of servicing those users. John, do you have anything to say on that one?
Yes, over the last several cost of service analysis, this has been pretty much a constant. Where there's some disparities between the different classifications. And I think the original cost of service showed a plan to bring them within the norm of cost of service, but it did result in substantial rate increases for some groups, including residential to some extent. Now, one thing I will say that we're looking at residential and others that are a little bit out of line, but this is typical for almost all public utilities. If we go to look at, let's say, Mason or Grace Harbor or any of the other PUDs, they have a very similar characteristic in that residential tends to be a little bit undercharged while and irrigation included in that for farms and such, while the other classifications tend to be a little bit overcharged. And Sergey, can you comment on that? You've probably seen that. We've looked at other utilities, and they have very similar characteristics. And it probably has to do with, you know, the nature of public utilities in general.
Yeah, the results are fairly consistent with many of the studies that we have done in terms of the findings. You know, the question is, you know, how far off? Everybody's going to be a little bit different how far off. And it goes back to policies that were made, and each utility is different in terms of the historical policy objectives. Now, some utilities do try to bring them in line and do a phase-in strategy over time. Others postpone those decisions until they get a little bit better data, depending on the kind of data they have today. They want to get a little bit more confidence in the data that they have. But the findings overall are fairly similar to what we're seeing in many other utilities.
Well, and yes, a very good point. We're still looking at data. We have better information coming in. AMI is helping as far as seeing when the load is actually used with respect to time of use, and that's going to play into it. But we have a question for the board. Is this something that we want to put as a high priority as far as the different rate classes, understanding that some rate groups will be dramatically impacted?
You know, in my previous life, representing a corporation, we belonged to an industrial energy users group that lobbied and gave testimony before PUCs throughout the country. It was always the accusation was that the industrial customers were subsidizing residential, and the residential said that the charge that they were subsidizing industrial. So this is kind of a typical type of outcome.
I was just going to make a quick comment before Sergey moves on regarding the irrigation. We are trying to phase that in. When we get to the breakdown of all the rates, irrigation, we're proposing not a 2.25% increase, but a 5.68% increase for 2022 and a 5.7% increase for 23. So it's not going to be the full 127% the next 2 years, but it is going to be increasing towards that cost of service over the next several years, probably over the next decade, to finally get there, Rick, to answer your question.
Yeah, thank you, Sean. I think my preference would be that each sector carries its own weight, but I'm not suggesting that we, in 1 or 2 years, modify the rates at exorbitant or increase them at exorbitant rates or percentages, but that in general that we move towards getting equitable.
Exactly. Yeah.
I would suggest looking at, you know, Grant went through this, and it was very disruptive to that utility. They raised the irrigation rate significantly. You might want to see what their experience was with that.
I might mention, like Sean said, that we've done it gradually. We've done the same thing on the water side. As you know, or maybe you don't know, we've been working to get a posted rate on the water side over the years, and it's been a slow progress, so no one's impacted with very large increases. So what Sean said is exactly what we've done in the past, and if the commission is okay with that, we'd continue to do in the future. Do something gradually, working towards a goal.
Yeah, let's avoid a step increase for any of these, and if we need to get to more equitable results, then we can gradually bend the curve.
When I get to the resolution, which is the next business item, I have a breakdown of all the proposed rates as well that are moving towards cost of service for each of these classes.
Sean or John or somebody, these seasonal irrigators on our water systems, are these typically people with big yards and so forth, or is this or there farms involved with this?
Basically, they're not big yards. They're there are in almost all cases the farms.
Okay.
The large irrigators.
Okay. Any other questions on the cost of service?
None for me.
That seasonal thing, does that include the marijuana grow operations? That's not seasonal, I wouldn't think. So.
No, irrigation is not where the grow operations are. The grow operations, if they're identified as such, would generally fall under the general service.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay. With that, we'll move on to that last step of the rate design, step three of the rate setting process. Now, overall, in terms of at least in my opinion, the number one priority here is that we, whatever rates we develop, they collect appropriate dollars identified in the first two steps. After that, we want to make sure the rates are cost-based and equitable as much as possible, but also convey the pricing signals and meet the utility's goals and objectives. And sometimes you're not going to have always the perfect alignment, cost basis versus goals and objectives. A good example always is low-income support rates versus equity. There's just not an equitable approach for establishing such a matter. So you're never going to have a perfect blend of cost basis and goals and objectives. So that's why we always say it's kind of a little bit of an art and science developing the final rate design proposed. So in terms of the goals and objectives we're trying to accomplish this time is we're moving forward to gradually making across-the-board adjustments to our classes, and we'll be focusing, again, on the next two-year cycle, so you'll definitely have a chance to revisit this again before the next Bonneville rate case occurs. Here, our emphasis is to make sure aligning our fixed charges with the cost of service-based unit costs, which we'll take a look in a minute. And then we also want to make sure we conform with the district strategic plan. So, again, not a lot of changes proposed this time around. The big goal will be once we get AMI data implemented, starting tracking AMI data, we'll have a lot of more tools available at our disposal, and at that point we'll be able to come and revisit a little bit more type of structural changes to modernize our alternatives or at least evaluate alternatives at that time. So before we talk about changes to rate structures, let's quickly take a look at the current rates that we have on hand today. So here you'll find a summary of the key classes of service that we have available, starting with the residential at the top. And kind of going to the right, you'll see the basic charges for either single-phase meters, which is where the majority of the residential customers are, three-phase meters, or energy charges. And then there will be a demand charge for some classes, usually the bigger commercial classes, but not for everybody. Now, what's important to remember, and you'll notice this in the next slide, is that just because somebody doesn't have a demand charge doesn't mean they don't have demand-related capacity upsizing demand costs. It's just that they're being recovered through one of these other alternative charges. So that's something important to note. So you can see the residential rate is about $39.55 for the basic charge and 7.61 cents. The small general rates, $43.59 and 7.55 cents. And then we go a little bit, the bigger the customer, medium general, $72.06, and they have a demand charge. Large general, three-phase only connections, $198, 5 cents, $5.53, and so on. Now, if we compare these to the cost-based unit cost, again, this is for 2022 only, you'll notice that every single customer class or the major customer class will have an energy charge component. It'll be quite a bit lower than what we saw in the prior slide that you currently charge because, again, these are cost-based. That also means that everybody would have a demand charge. So if we were charging at cost, everybody would have a demand charge, a type charge available to them. And then finally, the customer charge. Now, if you compare them to the prior slide, the residential customer charges based on cost basis can be increased slightly. Again, we're not recommending going to these cost-based charges right away or instantly over 2 years. We're just showing this is what the analysis indicated that the charges should be. Now, the question is, how do we progress or do we progress towards these cost-based unit costs? And what we're recommending, as you'll see, to take a really gradual approach, trying to get work our way towards there, but not necessarily go there all at one jump. So we'll start the discussion with the residential class, again, single-phase, mainly customers, because that's the majority of the customer classes. Here, the proposed adjustments are pretty much across the board. So you'll see that we're not doing a major adjustment to the basic charges the first year in 22, going from $39.55, about a 55-cent increase to the basic charge, and the rest of the increase coming through the energy charges. Again, the blue bars show you just the area of focus the next 2 years. Everything after that is, you know, subject to change. We're just showing you what it would look like, but it most likely could change depending the information that we get at that time. And then, as you can see in 23, we will be applying a 2.25% increase across the board, equally to both the fixed and the energy variable components to get the adjustments. And that's where that $3, about a $3.24, $3.06 adjustment comes in place for a typical average customer using 1,350 kilowatt hours per month. The table is down below the first table. We'll just show you different levels of usage because not everybody is perfectly on average. Somebody's lower, somebody's higher. So you can kind of see a different type of impact that they may have depending on the different usage level that you may be generating. Next, we'll take a look at the small general service. Again, majority of the customers are single phase, so we'll be focusing on that meter size here. Again, moving forward with across-the-board adjustments, phasing in the customer charges towards cost of service very gradually over time. Here we go from $43.59 to $46.48. Our energy rate goes up very gradually over time, so the overall increases are, again, at 1,625 kilowatt-hour average. Again, the average in this class, because the user is a little bit more broad, is a little bit more spread, but so we're just focusing on the average of the class, is still about $3.38 to $3.41 in the next 2 years. On the medium general side, we're phasing in the basic charges, and the energy and demand charges are increased at the same rate. Again, the increase is basically phased in on an across-the-board basis. Here, we're going up from $72 to $73 and then to $74. And as you can see, the energy charges are going up fractionally, 6.33 to 6.48 to 6.62 cents and so on. So for a typical customer using 21,250 kilowatt hours with an 84 kW demand, it's about a $40, $38, $39 increase. Again, the averages are going to be a lot more broad in these classes because here, the size of the customer may change. It could be a small grocery store or a mom-and-pop business. So just, again, it's not necessarily somebody's inefficient. It's just a different type of customer in one grouping. So you're going to have some customers that are a lot bigger, some smaller. Some of them are averaging in that 21,000 range. So we try to do a wider spread of potential differences in this class. Next, we have the large general service. Very similar across the board adjustments to their charges, the basic charge, energy charge, and then the demand charges. You can see that these folks are significantly bigger in size, and they can vary all the way up to 1 megawatt almost, as you can see from the sample bills. So there is a pretty big spread of potential bills and bill impacts for these folks. But overall, on average, 2.25%. Next, we have industrial, very similar type of adjustment. And then irrigation. On the irrigation side, we are moving mainly focusing on getting that basic charge in line to cost of service. So here we're focusing on bigger jumps proportionally for this class on the irrigation basic charges, going to $27 and then almost $30. The energy charges are for now kept flat because we're, again, emphasizing making that majority of the changes on their fixed charges, trying to catch them up. We're not being too aggressive here, gradually doing it. So if you want to make any more aggressive moves, we can either increase both the basic or the energy charge or even greater changes to the basic charge and leaving the energy charge unchanged. Sometimes it's easier to look things side by side. So on this slide, what you'll find are the summaries for every basic charge for every class. So you can kind of see under the existing column what everybody's currently paying, $35.55, that existing rate for the single-phase residential meter, $79.08 for a three-phase meter, and then the blue columns to the right showing how they change, as well as all other classes, single three-phase meters, as well as just their three-phase meter rates overall. So you can kind of see the overall averages going up to the right per year. We have a similar slide summarizing the energy charges. Again, the reason why it's smaller is just we don't need to look at the three-phase rates because the three-phase rates have the same energy charge as the single-phase rates for those customer classes. And then finally, the demand side. Here you'll see only three classes have a demand rate. Everybody else does not have a demand rate. They're paying energy only. Again, a reminder here is that just because they don't pay a demand charge, it just means that we're recovering their demand costs within their energy rate. And then the final slide before kind of wrapping everything up is just a quick survey. I always want to caution that these are apples and oranges comparisons because everybody's utility is different. Everybody has a different source where they're getting the electricity. Some folks have dams and outside resources they have access to, way cheaper power. Some folks defer maintenance. So it's always hard to find an apples and apples comparisons. I always say these are more like apples and oranges, but a lot of folks still like to see them. So here right now, if you're looking at the bars, the two bars that are different colors are representative of the Clallam existing rates. So currently at $142, we have the blue portion represents the basic charge, the gold portion represents the energy charge of a typical bill, and then we have the $145, the proposed rate. Again, the caution here is that we're proposing existing to 22 proposed versus these are for everybody, most everybody, these are 21 rates. And I'm pretty certain that at least a few of these, if not all of these folks, will be finalizing their rate studies and going through rate studies for 22 as well and be making adjustments. So it's, again, a little bit of an apples and oranges, but looking at the information presented, we're in the middle. We're going to remain to be somewhere in the middle in this comparison, even if nobody does anything with their rates. With that, this kind of concludes the presentation. Really, the feedback we're looking for is the revenue requirement. We identified that we're behind. The positive news is that we're doing better than we thought last time. So last time we're looking at 3.8% or so per year. Now we're at closer to 2.25% for the near term, 22 and 23, and preliminary look beyond that for a longer term as well. Cost of service, there are slight inequities that we are seeing. We're proposing to do a very gradual adjustment and not make significant changes at this point, you know, really emphasizing getting, implementing AMI and acquiring a lot better data before making any more drastic potential changes. And really continue to monitor equity distribution in your future updates. And finally, on the rate design, really focusing on trying to keep up our basic charges with those fixed costs of nature. The analysis identified that we are a little bit below on most of your classes on the basic charges. We're not recommending going there all in one jump. We're just recommending making at least small incremental steps to move forward towards cost-based unit costs. So with that, this concludes my share of the presentation. Do you have any questions or anything you want to go back or discuss about?
None for me.
Okay.
I guess I do. Uh-huh. I suppose this is for the staff, and it has to do with irrigation. We have historically, well, today and in the past, had lower rates, I guess, and we're going to substantially raise those over time at 2.25% for like everything else. But what was the, we were trying to make irrigation for farmers, that is, something that was not a, in other words, it was a reasonable lower cost to help farmers. Now, I don't know though, because you guys set these rates years ago that, you know, led to the situation we're in now where they're much lower than in a relative way to the other rates. Can John or somebody, provide some, give me some thoughts on that?
Yeah, Jim, the way you characterize it is correct, and the irrigation rates we have known have been, we believe, have been low for quite a few years. And, ultimately, it's during the rate-setting process many, many years in the past, that's what's led to where we are today. There is at least an irrigation and an obvious disparity.
Historically, I can say before even I got here, it's 15 years ago, it's been kind of like this. It hasn't been discussed a whole lot. And I think we're discussing it now, and we can do we can look into it further and see maybe where the history came from and why it was done the way it was. I know, as someone had mentioned here, that a lot of the other utilities have the same similar things, and certainly on the east side, they substantially have irrigators at a lower rate. So it's something the commission wants us to look in, commissioners want us to look into. We can look into it. Right now, as Sean and John are saying, we're slowly creeping up, just like we've done on the basic charges too, and we continue to do so on the basic charges, as other utilities have done.
So how large is this class? You know, agriculture is
not that big.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah, it's not that many customers.
Yeah, if you look at
but I'd hate to be running farmers off, you know, because they're already working at very thin margins, just, you know, because we're raising their rates when historically, you know, maybe we were trying to, you know, help these people. And it is such a small class that it doesn't have much overall impact to our, you know, revenue stream.
Yeah, Jim, you characterize it correctly. They're working with small margins, and such decisions were decisions made by previous boards.
This is Rick. I can understand and appreciate the logic there, but I'm concerned about equity. I have a real problem taking the cost from one customer group and spreading it over other customer groups.
Don't disagree with that, Rick. And why don't the commission let us look into it further, look into the history, and talk to other utilities on this too, and come back and let you know more about what we found.
You might want to talk to the irrigation districts on this too and get their input.
Definitely.
Okay.
Any other questions?
None for me.
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody.
Okay.
Thank you, Sergey.
Very good presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Okay. Take care. All right. Our next item is Resolution 2306-21, establishing the electric system rate schedules for 2022-2023. Sean, you had some information on that?
Yeah. So this immediately follows the presentation from the cost of service. And the resolution before you adopts the district's electric rate schedules for years 22 and 23, and which coincides with the BP 22 rate case. And this resolution, along with the presentation from Sergey, we posted on our website exactly 30 days ago. And to my knowledge, as of right now, we've received no comments on either. And the effective rates would be just like historically, they would go into effect April 1st of each year. And I don't know if you have a copy of the resolution in front of you, but It's got the breakdown of the rate schedule for basic customer charge, energy charge, and demand charge, and how each one of those is broken down. And it's just like it was in Sergey's presentation. There is one change to the resolution that was posted on the website. As you guys may know, the state is mandating a long-term care insurance for all Washington employees that goes into effect January 1st, 2022. And the change to the resolution, we just simply added a whereas provision giving Doug, our general manager, the authority to put a district program in place for the long-term care insurance, with the caveat that the rate adjustments would not be affected. So the 2.25 wouldn't be affected by any program that Doug puts into place to cover the long-term care insurance. So with that, if there's no questions, staff recommends the board approve resolution 2206-21 as presented, which is establishing electric system rates for April 1st, 2022 and April 1st, 2023, which is an effective increase across the board of 2.25% for each year.
John, this is Rick. Do we have enough flexibility to be able to hold off on this resolution until our next meeting? Because I would like to hear the feedback about the irrigation rates before I vote on this.
So just to answer your question on to clarify, we have put the entire increase for the irrigation rates into the basic customer charge. So the irrigation rate is going up 5.68% in 22 and 5.7% in 23. So it's more than double what we're doing for residential, for example, on the basic customer charge. And we're going to incrementally move towards the cost to serve that class. But as Jim mentioned, my understanding of the historical piece on the irrigation was that it was somewhat of a vocal group. And as Jim mentioned, they've been operating on thin margins, and it's about $68,000 to $70,000 a year. I don't want to use the word insignificant, but it's a very small portion of the district's rates. And if you need us to wait, Rick, I'm more than happy to do that. But we are doubling the rate increase for the basic charge in that particular class.
And I think, as you mentioned, Sean, too, that it's been sitting on the it's been in our on our website for the last month for the public to view.
That's correct.
I have the same request as Rick. I really think we need to reach out to irrigators because they're not necessarily looking at our website, and I don't know if we publish this in the paper or not. But I guess I would like to see us take a little bit more time on the irrigation piece.
I think historically, experience of other utilities, we can expect some pushback on this. So anyway, let's see how it goes. I guess we need to talk about how far out. We're going to push it out to the next meeting. Can staff do the work required that we've asked of them in that time period or not?
I guess it depends on the direction from the board. Are you just looking for us to pull what other utilities have done with irrigation, or are you wanting us to do something different?
I think it all comes, in my opinion, it all comes down to the equity thing. Plus, like Jim indicated, agriculture is on the decline, and they're operating on very small margins, and they may require some leeway there.
Well, Sean, if I may, this county has gone through and invested a lot of money in trying to retain small farmers in this area for resiliency purposes and jobs for people and so forth like that. And given that it's a small class and it doesn't have a big impact on us, I would ask that, and I guess maybe what Rick was maybe getting at too, is we maybe should reach out. I mean, you know, let's have a discussion about this with the irrigators, or at least let them know for sure that, you know, we're their rate class, you know, they're going up, and we're recognizing that we have ultimately want to raise their rates 126% or whatever it was. And I think we ought to be a little bit more aggressive in terms of communicating that with them.
And I think that what we need to communicate to them is our concern about they're not paying their fair share and spreading the cost over other customers. That, to me, fundamentally doesn't feel right.
Well, how do you know what those other customers feel? I mean, there's a lot of people in this county that support small agriculture and, you know, and have invested in it.
Indeed, and that's part of getting the word out and seeing what kind of feedback we get.
Okay.
So I guess it comes down to, can the staff afford to wait on this resolution until the next meeting and get done what we're requesting?
And does staff have a good handle on what we're requesting?
You know, I think it's a little difficult. I think if you reach out to them, of course, they're not going to like an increase. We could look at our past rate increases. I believe, and maybe Sean, too bad FCS is off, but I think over the years, I think we've increased slowly or increased them a little bit more so because there was quite a – oh, there. Okay, sorry. Okay. Are you aware, Sergey, whether our past, I think you've done one or two for us, mm-hmm. increases, also had increases in the irrigation side of it, too?
Yeah, so the prior increases were all average increases, and I want to make sure I clarify this, and Sean, please correct me if I'm speaking for the current resolution. While the basic charges are going up more than the average, their average increase is still in the 2.25 range. So their impact as the class is not going to be substantially greater. It's their basic charge. It's within the class how they're being collected. So at this stage of the game, we're not proposing anything drastic. It's just we're emphasizing the collection of it from the fixed charge, making sure their revenues are fixed. And in terms of the prior adjustments, we did not correct for equity at that time either. So they did not have a disproportionately large increase last time. I believe they had a proportionally equal increase, more weighted on the fixed charges as well.
Yeah, that's correct. We've been weighting the irrigation solely on the fixed charge. So, for example, in 21, seasonal irrigation went up 11.09% for the basic customer charge. And then in 2020, they went up 11.99%. So we've been slowly increasing them. We backed off a little bit on the basic charge this time just because they've just gotten hit with two almost 12% increases the last 2 years. And so this time it's 5.68 and 5.7.
And Sean, I don't know about you or John, but I haven't received any feedback from them in the past. Problem, have you?
No, not for 2020 or 21 rates. I didn't receive any feedback.
No, the only thing we're hearing is some people are at least less dissatisfied with the 2.25 increase compared to the previous year's 3.5. Now, the question I have for the board is, are we actually, you know, if we're increasing irrigation 2.25 this year and next year, and then we were thinking about migration towards class equity afterwards, and after we have basically almost all of our AMI installed, are we considering an additional increase for irrigation for the next 2 years, or are we just going out to as a sounding board on the proposed rate increase? Those are two different things.
This is just my opinion. I think that they should be increased at a greater than 2.25% so that we start closing that gap.
Yeah, I have a different view about that. I'd like to understand, you know, for instance, I would like to know which irrigators are in District 3. And so I might have a sense of what's going on there with them, impacts out here. But, you know, when you raise the base rate, you know, that disincentivizes any work they've done to become water efficient, in other words, by different irrigation practices and so forth. So that's another aspect that I'm wondering, you know, how they feel about that. But I wonder if they'd be, you know, if they, you know, most of these guys are so busy, they probably don't even realize we're talking about this right now.
I'm not aware of any irrigators in District 3, are you, John? I think most of them are in Squim.
Almost all of them in District 1, I believe. And how many are there? Do you recall, Sean, it's...
I don't have the customer count.
Is it 60 or something like that?
Yeah, I think there's 92 potentially, based on the historical that we had.
Well, I guess my take on it is that we've got the principal base position that we want equity across all the customer classes, but then we've got the more pragmatic approach that we don't want to put a lot of people out of business. So why don't we get some feedback from these irrigators and just see what their choke point is.
Yeah, maybe I would suggest that, you know, we put a, you know, something in the paper that says we talked about it and decided because of the irrigation issues, impact, or, you know, like equity with residential customers, base rate changes for irrigators and just the irrigators rate increase. We'd like a little bit more input from all people on this.
And just a final reminder here from the rates, the percent, even though percentages are a little higher, we're talking about $1.50 adjustment for any usage because the increase is for all basic charges only. It's $1.50 on average for everybody. So it's not, it doesn't scale with size, with the amount of the bill.
Well, I would anticipate that the irrigators would say, well, we're seasonal, so you don't have to come out and read our meters year-round. But then you have to counter that by saying, well, we still provide all the infrastructure to provide power to you when you need it. So you're going to have to make that argument.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a little concerned what we can really accumulate in the next 2 weeks or a month. We can certainly try. Like I said, I'm sure they would, just like any customer would say, they'd rather not have a rate increase. Whether $1.50 is
or 1 cent,
a major impact. And I mean, I guess I would like to, well, and it's up to the commission, obviously, go ahead and get it approved this time and make it a something that we can spend some time on it, more than 2 weeks or a month. Or, I mean, we do have to get the rate increase finalized, you know, before, well.
Well, not to interrupt you, Doug, but one thing I forgot, the resolution does incorporate the long-term care provision, and we have got to get that set up as soon as possible in the system. So we might have to do a special meeting if the commissioners want to hold off on this resolution just to get that passed.
Yeah, that has to have a deadline, actually, of November 1st, even though it's not – effective until January 1st, so we'd have to have things set up in the next, I would say in the next month, things would have to be going.
Well, why don't we go ahead with this resolution, talk to irrigators, and then we can make adjustments based on that information going forward. Does that sound reasonable?
This is Rick. I would say that we talk to as many customers as we can, not just the irrigators, but I'm okay with going with this resolution now and making this adjustment in the future.
Okay, good.
Hey, and this is John. So basically, we're taking our instruction. We kind of anticipated this. Rate class disparity is a big issue. And based on this conversation, when we proceed with the next rate adjustment, when we have more clear information and measures as to the disparity, then we will bring to the board basically a proposal of rate increases that may be different among all classes, and including for residential may include a fractionally higher increase to address the disparity. And we'll leave it to the board at that time on which way to go.
And I would suggest that instead of us not waiting a year to do this, that we start doing it right away. And, you know, over 5-6 months, we can start giving feedback to the board on what we're finding.
Works for me.
Yeah, that sounds like a good approach. So do we have a motion on this resolution?
I move that we accept resolution 2206-21.
Do we have a second?
I'm still debating. If you want to second it, go ahead. But
all right. Well, I'll second Rick's motion. So we've got a move. We've got a second. So let's go ahead and take a vote. The vote is to adopt resolution 2206-21, which established the electric system rate schedule for 2022-2023. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
I'm a nay at the moment.
Okay. All right. Our next item is acceptance memo for completion of the Forks Operation Building contract number 190804. Bill, are you still on? Put your cap on. We don't know who you are.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, this is acceptance memo for completion of the Forks Operations Building contract 190804. All work under the above reference contract with Interwest Construction has been completed. It is recommended that this work be accepted as complete. The project consisted of construction of a single-story operations building of approximately 11,640 square feet located at 241 Industrial Center, Forks, Washington, a wood-frame building with concrete slab on grade, metal siding and roof, new mechanical and electrical systems, including a standby generator, including the operations building and existing vehicle storage building. Site work included clearing, grading and fill, new base materials, gravel surfacing, pavement, new utilities, and storm drainage systems. Contractor started the project on April 20th, 2020, and completed the work on March 16th, 2021.
Okay, good. Thank you. Do we have a motion?
I move that we accept the memo of completion for contract number 190804.
I'll second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded to authorize acceptance of memo of completion for the Forks Operation Building contract number 190804 with Interwest Construction, Inc., for a total cost of $3,792,189.93, including Washington State sales tax. The project consisted of construction of a single-story operations building of approximately 11,640 square feet, locating at 241 Industrial Center in Forks, Washington. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah. Hey, Bill, I want a tour pretty soon here.
What's that?
I want a tour.
Yeah, come on out.
Okay.
I hope that applies to all of us. So yep. Not at the same time, though. Okay.
Yeah, anytime.
Okay, thanks. Our next item is an acceptance memo of completion pole inspection treating. Bill, you're on again.
All right. This is an acceptance memo of completion for pole inspection treating and reporting Clallam County, bid number 21-1003. The bid opening was on April 20th, 2021. All work under the above reference contract with Pacific Pole Inspection LLC has been completed. It is recommended that this work be accepted as complete. The project consisted of pole inspection treating and reporting an unspecified number of electrical transmission and distribution poles within Clallam County. Contractor started the project on June 14, 2021 and completed the work on July 23, 2021 for a total contract cost of $141,601.02.
And this was based on unit pricing, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Bill, was there anything significant that came out of the report?
No, it was actually quite well. The east end of the county, I think there was 7 rejects last year, and I think we're on par right about 7 rejects this year as well. So it went quite well.
Good. Thank you. I move that we accept the memo accept the completion of bid number 211003.
I'll second it.
Been moved and seconded to authorize acceptance memo of completion for pole inspection treating and reporting bid number 211003 with Pacific Pole Inspection, LLC. The project consisted of pole inspection, treating, and reporting of an unspecified number of electrical transmission and distribution poles within Clallam County. The total contract amount or cost is $141,601.02, including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, the next item here is post-2028 discussion. This is a standing item on our agenda. Whether we have anything to discuss at this point, I'm not sure. So we'll open it up for that discussion.
I do. I wanted to make sure that, and I think that we have consensus on 2 of the 3 issues, but since we're going to Bonneville meetings quite frequently, I wanted to make sure that where the other 2 commissioners were on 3 particular issues, Bonneville and melded rates, BPA joining CASO energy imbalance market, and BPA potentially joining the regional resource adequacy program that the power pool is putting together. I personally and am in favor of all 3 of those, but when I'm at meetings, I want to make sure that whether I need to speak for myself or whether I can speak for the PUD on those 3 issues.
Well, the hot issue on EIM was what was the impact on preference customers. Now, I know there was some kind of analysis done by Bonneville, which was favorable, but did we buy that?
Well, I do. Typically, as I understand it, when Bonneville enters into the secondary market, it's the hour ahead. The energy imbalance market is the current hour, so it will not affect or should not affect any secondary sales, as I understand it. My feeling is it just brings in the potential for extra revenue. I don't see Bonneville out there potentially selling into that market where it's going to hurt them in meeting their preference customer load. So therefore, it seems to me that all it does is bring in additional secondary revenues that could help potentially lower rates for all the customers. So I'm supportive.
But is that all in the agreement that Bonneville is going to make with CalISO?
Understanding is the energy imbalance market is only within the hour, and that's the only thing that they're looking at joining. Does that help, Will?
Well, the other piece of that, and this was discussed ad nauseum at PPC, is that EIM is part of CalISO, and we did succeed in putting a Northwest Public Power individual on their board, but that board is subordinate to CalISO's board. So there was a governance issue there, and so it really means that anything can change. So I'm not opposed to it, but I just think I'm not sure those questions were all answered. So.
Yeah, let me mention, we did get a letter from our email from the transmission account executive, and she said, let's see here, to address customer concerns about limited comment period, BPA posted the draft letter 4 days in advance of the August 2nd target date in order to give customers more time for review. BPA is accepting comments on this draft EIM closeout letter until August 23rd and expects to release the final EIM closeout letter on September 28th.
Well, I guess, Rick, if you would ask some of those questions as a position, that would That would put me in the favorable column. Jim, did you have anything?
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of like you, Will. I'm not exactly in the favorable column right now. I realize that the impacts to our PUD may not be that great. The revenue projections are just that, projections, and there's a lot of skepticism about, you know, what we actually will see. And I also note that at the WAPAG meeting, I guess there was some sort of survey done on terms. Oh, there was a presentation on this a bit, and they asked people, utilities that were involved already in this, and they didn't even mention the cost savings. All they said, well, it's got some pretty good qualitative aspects. In other words, we got a better handle on, you know, how to engage with others and balance resources and stuff like this, or on the day ahead market or the hourly market, whatever the parameters are. But they didn't. It was interesting. They didn't talk about, you know, what kind of savings they were, or money they were generating from this. So I'm still sort of skeptical. I don't know why that we have to have a for sure position at this time. I think it's better to keep asking questions and always be asking questions about this.
Yeah, and I wonder if this is, you know, with Elliot down at Cal ISO, and he was very in favor of this, if not joining Cal ISO. Is this a lead-in to that? That would be another question I would like to hear some more from Bonneville. But anyway, Rick, did that satisfy you? Probably not, but anyway.
Well, I guess since the feedback is only on the EIM, we're all on the same page with being okay with melded rates and Bonneville joining the Regional Resource Adequacy Program.
Well, on the melded rates, now, I think John sent an email to WAPAG, if I'm not mistaken, that talked about melded rates, and I was supportive of what you said there, John.
That was feedback for the customer choice after the BPA presentation, and my staff's opinion is that it would be favorable to our district if BPA returned to melded rates that existed prior to the tiered methodology. So I believe all commissioners saw that email, and if there's no disagreement with it, I guess it would be fine to convey that as the PD position.
Okay, that sounds good to me, if everybody agrees with that.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, I do too.
Okay, so on your third point, Rick, about the RA program, this one I still have a lot of questions about too. And I guess, you know, the discussions have been going on is that since we're a load following customer, basically BPA, when they get into this thing, they'll be the ones making the decisions about what resources to, you know, allocate and so forth. And I talked to Ryan Neal about it because I wanted a little bit more information this morning. I guess it's, you know, we don't have much choice at this point. It looks like BPA is going to do this. And the only good news is, well, I wouldn't say it's only good news, but I mean, it's better. They're going to go ahead, but for the first 2 years, it's not binding. And so, and the reason is to help us work through some of these specific issues in terms of how it is BPA is going to engage in the RA program and make it work for all customers, whether they're slice block or load following. And so I guess it's like EIM. I'm still, you know, we need to work on this because I don't think there's a big impact to CLOW and PUD, but still, if it positive or negative for BPA, that's going to affect our rates.
Well, this is an improvement over what Elliot said a couple of years ago, that resource adequacy wasn't a concern for Bonneville. I assume that's changed with John Hairston. In fact, I know it does, but the piece of that are they working with the Northwest Power Pool, and I'm on a task force for Energy Northwest on resource adequacy. Is Bonneville proposing to coordinate with those other activities? Do you know that, Rick?
That's my understanding, is that they would be working with the Northwest Power Pool.
Okay, great, good.
Yeah, well, yeah, and you know that the power pool put out last week this design for the resource adequacy program that's 250 pages long. And most people have never done this, but it's almost like reading a mortgage-backed security or something derivative plan. It's very complex, and it still doesn't have any real prices or numbers in it because it's all theoretical at this point. And it also, all this is based on the assumption that we have a serious shortfall in resources. And that was projected 3 years ago by the power pool in those meetings they had, you know, back in early 2019 and continuously. And so, the part that gives me a headache, this is a bit at odds with what the Northwest Power and Conservation Council is putting out. And even in their power plan, their draft power plan will be coming out any day now. You know, they're still showing, surpluses, you know, winter surplus of 20%, summer peak surplus, and these are peak surpluses of 10% in 2023.
Jim, is that from the council?
Yes.
And yeah, and you've been reading about all the issues they've been having with their models, and I personally have some real issues with, you know, you're using a model and it's showing your deficit, you make some changes to the model and all of a sudden we're surplus, which is my understanding of what happened with the council's model.
Well, what they're doing is they're, you know, and I've participated in many, many of these meetings, in fact, 3 days last week, where they went through each dam in the hydro system and looked at the flexibility to generating and so forth, and compared that against also with climate change. I think what they're doing is they're refining the model based on things they discover, based on comments they get and so forth. And that's what, you know, that's what they're doing, Rick. Sure, a model is tough. This is a very complex model. There's no doubt, and there's going to always be some warts with it. But I think it's, you know, it would behoove us to pay more attention or pay a lot of attention to what the model is doing and comment on it and so forth. And let's not forget, we pay the council, I mean, about $120,000 a year is our contribution to the Conservation Council. And so, you know, that's, you know, we are, you know, they're a customer. So we need, I mean, we're a customer of them. So we ought to be, you know, listening to what they say. And I think that, you know, there's still issues that need to be worked out within the model. But I think what overall it keeps showing, and, you know, I confirmed this with Pat Oshie, one of the council members this morning, is that, you know, there's definitely, the future, you know, with lower prices is causing a lot of issues in terms of natural gas commitments, in terms of hydropower in general, and no one is answering the cost side of the question for BPA, even the council, and that's a problem that I've complained to them about. And so I think that the resource adequacy issue in general is still I charged with a lot of or a fair amount of, information that's hard to put a finger on. I've tried to look into the basis for the resource adequacy. In other words, the plan references previous studies. Well, I've looked at those previous studies. There's not a whole lot of depth and substance to them. Whereas the model, you know, that they're using now, the upgraded Genesis, is a very powerful tool. And I think, you know, it behooves us to pay attention to the assumptions they're using on hydropower and the energy markets in general and the cost of solar, wind, and batteries and so forth. And I think they're really, you know, we're paying them to put an effort into this thing. So I guess that's my view of the council's modeling.
Well, you know, what we're talking about here is staff work. And I talked to some of the council members. They have not reached a consensus on this, so maybe premature. I think there is a resource adequacy problem looming out there. And so anyway, Rick, does that give you some talking points?
I think all I heard is that we agree that we support melded rates.
Yes.
And I think that
support the other two on my own then.
Bonneville taking responsibility for resource adequacy is almost a no-brainer. So anyway.
And I might add that on the EIM, that I think Ryan's actually pushing the points that you've all mentioned. So, you know, he is concerned about it, and he's putting forth the points that we've talked to him about, too.
Right.
Okay, is that?
That's good for me.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, let's take a short break, and we'll come back for correspondence communications. Okay, I didn't specify a time for this break. Okay, Jim's back, so let's move on to correspondence communication. Doug, do we have anything?
Yeah, just real quick. We've got some presentations here a little later, so I want to move quick. Just to let you know that we started Truck and Water last week out to Island View Water System, which is a stage four. We've got Column Bay and CQ on a stage three, which is kind of mandatory outdoor water restrictions, you know, like no vehicle washing, things like that. We've got, let's see, Fairview, Evergreen, Carlsberg, and Panoramic Heights water on a voluntary water conservation stage two. That was based on Governor Inslee's declaring a statewide drought emergency because of low snowpack and low river flows. Now, the three systems that we don't have any alerts on are Gales, Mount Angeles, and Monroe. And that's pretty much because we purchased water from the city of Port Angeles, and the city hasn't announced any water use advisory. So just to give you an update on where we are on our water systems.
Yeah, I think Bonneville reported that available water was about 85% of normal, something like that. So we'll see how that goes. Anything else, Doug?
No, that's all right now.
Okay, our next item is commissioner reports. Let's mix things up. Jim, you want to start?
Yeah, let's see. Boy, I ought to go back in my notes. It's been months here. I sat in on the Waputa meeting, and I guess I'll let Rick talk about the Energy Committee since he was there for that. He's the designated member. But anyway, I sat in on some of the other, meetings and so forth. I'm trying to see if there's anything really noteworthy here.
I also participated in the North Unlimited Development Council's meeting here a few weeks ago. They're in the process of setting up, I guess, roughly named something like a five-year economic development plan. So they're asking for, some additional participation, an all-day workshop or something. Anyway, that's their ongoing with that and doing a survey. And then WAPAG meeting on the 29th of July, we had some various presentations. Again, we talked about EIM, the provider of choice comments. we had an interesting discussion about the 200 kilowatt limit or constraint that BPA has on utilities that want to add resources, and that no one had ever asked to raise that threshold for a non-federal resource. And so there's WAPAG did some analysis on that, and it shows that even up to 1 megawatt, there's very little financial impact on BPA to take that on, to add those resources. So I think we're going to suggest that. The question I had was, do you have to wait on the 2028 process, or is that something they could do now? That's still an open question, I think. I also sat in on quite a few of the public Power and Conservation Council, but most of that stuff is already covered in our previous conversation. Let me see if there's anything else along that lines. There was one.
No, I think that's the key points from those meetings. That's all I got, Will.
Okay, thank you. Rick, you want to go next?
Ed, I've been to a couple of BPA provider of choice meetings, WAPUTA, PPC meeting, and the audit meeting for PPC. Good meetings all. The WAPUTA Energy Committee meeting mostly provided a update on the legislation of the number of bills that relate to the energy market. And since this is pretty dated at this point, I don't see any reason to go through those. I did have one question for Sean. I think I heard you say that we do have energy assistance program required by CETA, which was required that we have that in by the end of July. And I think you said, confirmed that we have that squared away.
We do, Rick. Yeah, it actually took effect towards the beginning of July, so we are definitely in compliance with that provision.
Okay. One of the other things I thought was interesting is that one of the bills that's being pushed through, or was SB 5472, requires that before we disconnect anyone, that we have to do an on-site visit, which I thought was interesting. I'm sure you're aware of that.
My understanding was WAPUTA was obviously very against that bill, and they were going to be monitoring the progression of that. But yes, that would be extremely onerous for all utilities to have to go through such a practice. And in fact, it'd almost be impossible to do something like that.
So I'm assuming that our regional or statewide organizations are taking the lead on pushing back on that?
They are. WAPUTA is definitely taking the lead on that. In fact, I think it's George who's actually taken the lead on that one, the president of WAPUTA.
Okay. That's all I've got, Will.
Okay, thank you. Well, I've had a couple of hectic weeks at Energy Northwest. I had to go to meetings 2 weeks ago and turn around and go to meetings again, which is requires quite a drive. I know every rock and tree along that route now. What the issue was, we're, of course, hiring a new CEO, and I think you probably saw the announcements, but what we did was we had executive sessions where we interviewed four internal candidates, they're all vice presidents at Energy Northwest, and one external candidate. I was on the CEO candidate selection task force, and we came up with some very good candidates, and we knew that the four people at internal were part of a very well-functioning management team. And of course, you always have the concern that if you don't pick one of them, you might lose some people. But in any case, then we followed that up with a executive board meeting last week where we named Bob Schutz as the new CEO. Bob is he's retired from the Navy. He was a captain. He was actually commander of the Pacific Submarine Fleet before he retired. Has tremendous leadership experience. Of course, military leadership is a little different, but he presented very well. He's also worked at INPO as a plant inspection leader, and he's worked at Energy Northwest for 10 years, and he's risen to the vice president level. We talked to the other candidates, explained our choice, and tried to fill them out as to what the impact of that was. The acting CEO, who is Grover Heddle, he indicated at first we were concerned because it appeared that he was pretty upset over not getting the job. But after that, he did sign an agreement, and looks like he'll be staying on. The other two, our chief general counsel, Scott Vance was one of the candidates, very sharp guy. He's got a PhD from MIT in nuclear engineering, plus his law degree, and on. He's got a tremendous resume, and we'll just see how that works out. He's been a real asset to Energy Northwest. And the other candidate was Greg Cullen, who is vice president and heads up the ESD portion of Energy Northwest, which includes the small modular reactor, and he has brokered those agreements with Department of Energy, Grant, PUD, who looks like they've signed a memo of understanding, but we'll see if they want to go forward with actually owning, installing a an SMR based on different technology than NuScale. But they also have signed a memo of understanding with NuScale, so that's kind of up in the air. But in any case, Greg's done a great job. He's a young guy that has a huge amount of potential. So we'll just see if he decides to stick around. He'd be a loss if he decided to move on. Anyway, Bob, I've communicated with Bob. I'm the chairman of the executive board right now, so we talk frequently. He sounds like he's got all the right attitudes and wants to retain the people and keep that successful management team together. We've got a workshop for the Energy Northwest Executive Board on 24th through the 26th of this month. We're going to talk about policies, talk about structure of the e-board, the committees, and also talk about issues that are out there like relicensing Columbia, our efforts in SMR, and what we should do with that. Plus, there's on the table, there's an upgrade, an uprate of Columbia, which would mean changing out major components over many refueling outages. Had a pretty hefty price tag. Bonneville is not totally bought into it, so we'll just see how that goes. But we're going to get the final numbers, the economics, the financial analysis, and so on in that workshop. So that's all problems and not a lot of solutions. So anyway, any comments, questions on that?
Will, though, I have a couple of things I forgot.
Oh, okay, sure. Go ahead.
First, I'd like to ask about a potential for using a letter of credit with respect to our finances and reserves. And the second point I had was there's a Steve DiPrio that's asked in the comments section that he'd like to ask a question. I don't know if he's still out there or not.
Steve, are you still there?
That would come under.
I'm still here, but I had a general question. It wasn't about anyone's actual presentation today.
Well, if you'll hold that, we're going to have comments from the public later on. Or do you want to? You can go ahead now if you like.
No, I can wait. I can wait until you guys are ready for that.
He's asking for a public comment, Will.
Okay. Is that all you had, Rick?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. All right, staff reports. First, we've got a brief report on the district's internship program. Colin?
Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioner Purser. Colin PUD has collaborated with Energy Northwest for their internship program this summer. Applicants applied through Energy Northwest, and we were able to look at an extensive list of candidates to pick the one we wanted. Our HR department also deserves a lot of credit for their help in the process to bring an intern on board at the PUD. We believe the internship program has been beneficial not only to the intern, but the engineering department as well. Titan Burson, a Clallam County resident, is starting his fourth year on a five-year track in college with a major in mechanical engineering focused on power production at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, Arizona. During his internship, he contributed to multiple projects, and he spent time with different departments to learn how utility works. His main task was to develop designs for a 100 kW solar PV system. Starting from site selection, for wiring diagrams, and then cost estimation. Although this project is not in our current work plan, the design he came up with will make it possible to implement this in the future. Please welcome our engineering intern, Titan Burson.
Titan, are you on?
I am.
Okay, good. So you're going to cover our next item, which is you're going to talk about this project, this solar project.
Yes. Let me see if I can share my screen real fast.
I'll just say real quick, there's a lot of enthusiasm at Energy Northwest with this intern program, and they would appreciate feedback on it. So as we get through this, let's do that.
Okay. I'm guessing you're able to see my presentation right now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yes, we see it.
Thank you. So my name is Titan Burson, like Colin stated, and this is the Johnson Creek Train Trestle Array. I came up with that name because the location that we're planning on putting it, the solar array, is by the substation, and I'll show you. So the first part is, why do we choose the Johnson Creek substation? The primary reason why is because, one, we're going to be super close to a substation that we can tap our power generated into a substation with, and we also already own the land that is already relatively cleared, where there's very few trees and shrubs that need to be removed. So getting the land ready to be built on is very minimal for the amount of work. The other contender would have been the lot at our engineering location in Carlsberg. It's the empty lot. The only issue about it is that we would not be able to build any future buildings there, such as offices or garages or whatever we need to have built in the future for maintenance. So we came down to a choice of a few types of panels to model the array with. And out of the plethora there are on the market, I decided to choose the four: Panasonic, SunPower, Qcell, and Canadian Solar. So after choosing the panels, I decided to run it through a series of Excel tests to see what our wattage degradation would be after the course of 25 years, because, well, in the real world, nothing ever works at 100% after a couple of years. So in order to figure that out, we basically found the degradation value of the panel and then applied it over the course of how long it should be installed and ran for in a practical set. So we then figured out what our price per kilowatt hour would be for the panels. And through the testing, we figured that, or we found out that the the Canadian Solar panels were our best option. They were maybe not the best at efficiency after 25 years compared to SunPower or Panasonic, but they did have a lower price per kilowatt test than all the other competitors, going to, I believe, let me move this out of the way, 62 cents per kilowatt hour over the course of 25 years. So this is just kind of a panel or a slide on just the math on how our array is going to look like, or what I kind of figured out that it should look like. We're going to have a total of 284 panels. 270 will be in the array with an additional 14 spare panels in the event any of the panels get shipped, broken, you name it. We'll have three rows in a 3x30 landscape format. And for inverter-wise, we're going to have 15 panels connected to a single string, and then there's going to be six strings to one inverter. Therefore, we're going to have roughly three inverters in one row, or 90 panels in one row, too. So for the structure, I decided to model it off the same structure we modeled off of the Slim Solar Array. So the pricing should be about the same, plus or minus maybe a couple hundred dollars. So it's the RBI structure, and since our train trestle array will be three times the size of the City of Swim, it's just kind of standard 3 times the amount of supports to support our system. Our string inverter versus the microinverter. So there's 2 different types of inverters on the market. And an inverter's job is to convert the DC power from the panels to an AC power so we can attach it straight to the power grid. So a central inverter has a series of strings that would have multiple panels attached to these strings that feeds the voltage over the course of it running over the day cycle. A microinverter will convert the power at the panel, and then it will transfer it directly to the meter from there. You don't need to have a series of multiple panels in one set string. You just do it right there at the panel. So for our case, I chose a string inverter called the SMA Tri-Power 33.3 kilowatt string inverter. The train trestle array is modeled to have 3 string inverters, and if we were to use microinverters, we would have used an additional $27,660 for a total of 270 microinverters. This is going to be the solar array design from a satellite view. The white border would represent a fence that we would have to place around it. The fence is both a practical reason for PUD, so we can keep our site secure, but also for City of Swim requirements. They require a 7-foot-tall fence boundary for all buildings. It cannot be a chain link fence because of, it cannot be a chain link fence. Chain link fence unless it is a city utility, but we do not classify as a city utility. And the dotted lines represent any underground wire or conduit that we will have running through the proposed area. This is a wiring diagram that I made to represent what the overall solar array would look like. It is not to scale, but basically, the idea is that we're going to have about 90 panels attached to every inverter, and we'll have 3 sets of these inverters totaling up to 270 panels running at one given point. The other thing about these panels, about the Canadian solar panels, is that they are bifacial, meaning that they can generate power on both sides. Bifacial panels have been on the market for about 10, 15 years, so there's a lot of different variations of them. But on a more than ideal day, you could see what the seller is saying is that you can see about 30% increase in wattage per panel, and they can still generate energy in the event that the front panel is covered in layer of dirt or dust or even snow. The cons, though, on it is that they require additional variables such as an increased amount of height, specialized frames and angles, and a high surrounding albedo, which means how reflective everything around it is, like how much light can be bounced off of metal or rocks or gravel or whatever. The other cool thing about bifacial panels is that across parts of Europe and Asia, certain companies are doing research and designs on bifacial panels for agricultural reasons, where they'll lean them exactly vertical, and they'll have these solar fences installed in large rural areas that act as a fence for livestock, but also will generate power and provide farmsteads with power or small rural areas with power over the course of the their years of how much power they use. This is just a rough sketch on how the power works for how a bifacial panel works, because I always find images always help with a full understanding. So we can see that obviously we'll have direct sunlight come. Oh, it will help generate on the front side of the panel, but also on the back side of the panel, since that's where all the bifacial power is generated. Anything from clouds having light reflected through them to the ground or even the metal posts will generate a small amount of light reflected that'll bounce back up to the bifacial side. So there is multiple alleyways, per se, that you can use these bifacial panels. Now comes the part that really matters, the bill of materials and the final cost. So for any individual cost, please refer to the pricing underscore V2 Excel sheet. That's going to be where all the individual prices are going to be located at. Anything to the price of all the solar panels, to the structures, even gravel and plant removal. For our total cost for the actual building of the array, the model that I produced came out to be $241,904.30, making our price per watt roughly $2.42. The cost for 25 years of upkeep should be roughly $18,750. The cost of building a border fence and gate should be around $76,000. That's including inflation and recent increases in price for both lumber and labor because of the COVID-19 shortages. And the total cost for the Johnson Creek train trestle array is $336,654.30 for a levelized cost of 12.9 cents per kilowatt hour. The Johnson Creek train trestle array also has the ability to be expanded upon in the future with an additional 219 panels or 86.5 kilowatts, not including bifacial. And then just to compare it to the SWIM solar arrays, we are looking at, so the SWIM solar array had a total installation cost with the exception of the fence of $126,600, leading to a levelized cost of 15.8 cents per kilowatt hour. And removing the fence from the Johnson Creek array cost, total cost would be leading us to a levelized cost of 9.9 cents per kilowatt hour, or 40% less than the SWIM solar array. This is just a little thing about what I learned over the course of my summer here at PUD. I learned how to use SCADA and our Clallam County's power grid with how we also meter our customers. I learned how our substations and how BPA supplies Clallam County through the various points that BPA supplies us from. I learned how engineering plans for future expansion and maps and routes our grid and our power supply. I also got a chance to work with a few of the departments in PUD, such as Matthias and Tyler King. I also got to work with Sean Delplane and the metering department. I also got to see and learn how solar arrays work. This is the first time I really got a chance to touch solar arrays to this depth, and it's a really interesting field. And I also learned how a lot of educational stuff, such as power factor. Any questions? I hope I didn't fly too this flight.
No, it's a very good presentation. If you don't mind, could you just give us a little synopsis of your background? What are you doing educational-wise and so on? Sounds like you're on your way to being an engineer.
Well, as of right now, I am still going to school. This is going to be, like Colin said, my fourth year coming up out of my 5 years that I'm doing for my degree track. It's really interesting. I was originally going to be an aerospace engineer, and I kind of got burned out in my initial structures class, so I found out I had a love for thermodynamics, so that's why I'm going down to energy production, and I thought, hey, might as well see if Clallam County PUD, my home county, has any internships this summer, and turned out I applied right at the perfect time, so that's how I got this internship.
Oh, great. That sounds good. Having gone through the engineering thing and changing majors a few times, that's an important decision. But anyway, well, thanks for your input and welcome to Clallam PUD. I think you've done a great job on this project.
Thank you.
Great. I have a question.
Yes?
Maybe Purvis can answer this. I'm not sure. Does that array fit on top of the our warehouse there across the street from the office building?
If I had a guess, I wanted to model it. I'd have to go check and double check for the amount of square footage that we would need. If we wanted to go for probably our standard solar panels that are non-bifacial, we probably would have enough space to probably put maybe 25 kilowatts, 50 kilowatts on the roof on our engineering building and the warehouse alone. I'd have to double check and model it through our MathLife program.
Well, maybe that's something for us to think about, but I think those bifacial panels would work well on the roof of a building that's got, you know, a silver coating or something on it.
It would work that way. The only issue is you need to do a certain frame because bifacial panels do not work if there is a lack of height between the panels of a roof versus the panel distance of the bifacial panel. They say that you want to have roughly at least a meter distance, so 3 feet as the most typical. So for bifacial panels, ground mounts are the most optimal. But there are research being done on how roofs, a roof mounted bifacial panel can work, but it is a different kind of setup. So you would need a certain type of mounting equipment, and you would also need to have a certain paint coating for your roof for it to be the most optimal to account for the lack of distance.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Other questions, comments? Okay, well, thank you very much, Titan.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. All right, board action items. Did we capture any, T? Oh, T's not here. Sorry.
He's not on. This is Nicole. I'm kind of taking some notes, but okay. I don't know that there was any action items. You guys went ahead and you voted on the rate thing. So we're not postponing that.
I believe, Nicole, I believe Rick had a staff inquiry that he was requesting on a line of credit.
That's correct. For reserves.
Oh, the LLC, okay.
So what are we talking about doing there? Are we going to look at the return on our reserves versus the cost of maintaining a line of credit and other factors as well?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, I got that down, Rick.
Okay, thank you. Anything else, Nicole?
How does the irrigation follow-up fit into this? Is it an action item, or what are you calling that?
Yeah, we could put that as an action item that staff be looking over the next 5 or 6 months into the cost of service regarding irrigation costs or rates.
Okay, thanks.
Irrigation, okay.
Okay, so we have our action items captured. We do not have an executive session. Anything else for the good of the – wait a minute. Did I skip
public comments.
Public comments, sorry.
Yeah, well, I have one from the chat from Steve DePiro, but if anybody else would like to also make a comment, please give me your first name now.
So is now a good time for me to chat? This is Steve DePiro.
Yeah, go ahead, Steven.
Hello, everybody. A couple of you guys on the call today know who I am. I've resided here in Guam County for a few years now. Recently, a couple of years back, purchased a property at 1737 West Highway 101. I think I'm the closest resident to State Highway 101, probably to anybody, you know, anywhere along the highway. I can spit and hit the right turn lane from my front door. It's been made aware to me since you guys have proceeded with this new transmission tower project that my property is 4 feet into the easement of the state right-of-way, which the DOT owns, which is also causing more issues besides the legal ramifications of me being partly in the city and partly in the county. The real issue is I'm having a high voltage line now. You know, from what I've studied, it can go anywhere from 69,000 volts to 765,000 volts. And right now the line that we purchased when we bought our house only has a 69,000 volt maximum distribution line, which, you know, I really honestly didn't make notice of that when we purchased the house. We looked at this for our livestock. And after looking at your large poles, these things are huge. I agree completely. We need the new infrastructure. And I'm trying to pursue some type of, you know, agreement with the PUD for you guys to figure out a way to either move this house or change the way the lines are running. But I currently, as it stands, will have your high voltage lines above my bed at night. And there's, you know, stuff online, you read research, it's not like, you know, I don't think it's been proven in any court, but leukemia is shown to, you know, be higher with children living under power lines than not. I have three little kids, one with an immune disorder. So there's quite a few different pain points that this is causing me. And I want to bring to your attention that you guys did pursue an easement for 30 feet. For $1,000, your lawyer did this in a letter to me. And I would like to see how PUD's appraisal for that setback of $1,000 was calculated. That includes my home, and it was very underhanded, very underhanded. And, you know, from day one, me and the PUD have not gotten along because of the treatment I've encountered with them. So I just need to go on the record today, let you guys know I'm against this, and anything you can do to help me would be appreciated.
So when was this agreement consummated?
The agreement for the
right-of-way.
The right-of-way, that was my first encounter here in 20, I want to, I'm just going by memory, about 2019 we were logging. I had a DNR permit. My logger fell a tree on the power line. You guys came to my wife, I wasn't home, and said we were liable. Sooner, it was like later on that day, our logger took responsibility for it and I believe paid whoever was injured. I wasn't sure about that part. I know it wasn't us, but it was after that you guys came and wanted to, the PUD representatives wanted to fall nearly all the trees on my property line, which I intentionally, you know, wanted up to, you know, for my livestock that I have and for privacy. And that was essentially when that agreement had occurred. They tried to buy this easement from me back then.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
All right, any questions, comments for Stephen?
Oh, thanks, Steve, for your comments.
Yeah,
thank you. And I do want to, I also would like to, this is not related to my home, but I'm also under the impression that you guys are considering placing 5G repeaters on some of the transmission lines, and I'm a huge I've done a lot of research on 5G and I'm not for it. So if that's something you guys are going to consider, I would like to be allowed to speak on that, if that's going to be something that does occur in our county, because I have a lot of data on that.
Okay, you're welcome anytime. Okay, other comments, Sean?
I heard no other comments and received none from the chat, Will.
Okay, we do not have an executive session, so there's no other business to come before the board. We stand adjourned. Thank you for attending.